With Lucky Land Slots, you can get lucky just about anywhere.
Dearly beloved, we are gathered here today to... Has anyone seen the bride and groom?
Sorry, sorry, we're here. We were getting lucky in the limo and we lost track of time.
No, Lucky Land Casino, with cash prizes that add up quicker than a guest registry.
In that case, I pronounce you lucky.
Play for free at LuckyLandSlots.com. Daily bonuses are waiting. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
As a longtime foreign correspondent, I've worked in lots of places, but nowhere as important to the world as China. I'm Jane Perlez, former Beijing bureau chief for The New York Times. Join me on my new podcast, Face Off, U.S. versus China, where I'll take you behind the scenes in the tumultuous U.S.-China relationship. Find Face Off wherever you get your podcasts.
Hello and welcome to History Tea Time. I'm Lindsay Holiday, and I'm spilling the tea on history. Black aristocrats and celebrities of 18th century England and France. Popular historic dramas like Bridgerton, Hamilton, and Sandition sometimes receive criticism that their racially diverse casts are historically inaccurate. But in fact, there have been people of color in Britain and France since the Roman times. By the 18th century, the transatlantic slave trade brought more people of African descent to Europe than ever before. In 1768, there were about 15,000 black people living in London. Many were brought there as enslaved servants and sailors, but some had the right mixture of talent and luck to rise to the upper echelons of society, becoming celebrities and even aristocrats. Today, we'll meet seven prominent people of African and mixed heritage who lived in Britain or France in the 18th century. Among them, a king's secret daughter, an icon of both sport and music, two authors who spoke out against slavery, and a lady of wealth and refinement who would have fit perfectly into the world of Bridgerton. Here are their stories. Louise Marie Therese was delivered to the Abbey of Moray in 1665 when she was a young child. Where she came from was the biggest mystery of her life. Many at the Palace of Versailles whispered that the mysterious black nun of Moray was really the daughter of Queen Maria Theresa, the wife of Louis XIV of France. The king was far more interested in his mistresses than his wife. Check out my videos all about it. Once the queen produced an heir, the king only occasionally visited her bedchamber. Left to her own devices, the queen surrounded herself with friends and confidants, including, as was fashionable at the time, an African servant with dwarfism named Nabu. In 1664, Maria Theresa gave birth to her third child, a baby girl who was tragically stillborn. An eyewitness noted the infant appeared a little dark. This is not unusual for babies who have been deprived of oxygen in the womb. But for years after, the word at Versailles was that the princess had not died, but had been secreted away because she was black. Scientifically naive gossip mongers noted the queen's love of hot chocolate and theorized that this was why she had given birth to a dark-skinned child. But the prevailing assumption was that the queen had an affair with her attendant Nabu. It was expected for a king to commit adultery, but for a queen it was unthinkable. It has since been alleged that Nabu was banished from the palace, or even that he was imprisoned and was the mysterious man in the iron mask. But in fact, he continued to work at Louis's court long after the queen's death in 1683. Once Maria Theresa died, rumors about her long-lost child really flared up. Many courtiers went to visit the mysterious black nun of Moray to see if they could identify the queen's traits in her and solve the enigma. Louise had been delivered to the Moray monastery by a trusted royal advisor shortly after the queen's tragic delivery in 1664. The only problem was that she had been a child of about 5, not a newborn baby. Historians now think it more likely that the nun was actually King Louis's illegitimate daughter, with an unknown woman of African descent. There are several clues to this theory. One, she was named Louise, after Louis, and the king would never have allowed the child of his wife's lover to be named after him. Two, she was granted a generous allowance of £300 a year from the king's treasury. Three, court artist Pierre Goubert was sent to make a portrait of her titled The Religious Black Princess, which was included with other now missing documents in a folio titled The Moorish Daughter of Louis XIV. Four, courtiers who met Louise, including Voltaire, remarked on her strong resemblance to the king, not the queen. Louise herself was sure of her royal parentage. When the Dauphin came to meet her, she greeted him as my brother. Madame de Maintenon, King Louis's secret second wife, visited her often and attended the ceremony during which she took her holy vows. Louise told Maintenon, the trouble which a lady of your station takes to purposely come here and tell me that I am not the daughter of a king persuades me that I am. Louise was no fool. She lived out her life at the convent and died at the age of 68. The mysterious black nun inspired the opening of a less than subtle chocolate factory in the town of Moret. Ignatius Sancho was born aboard a slave ship crossing the Atlantic. His mother died shortly after they arrived in the Spanish colony of New Granada, modern-day Colombia. His father took his own life rather than live enslaved. When Ignatius was 2, his owner took him to Greenwich, England, and gave him to 3 unmarried sisters. They treated him like a pet and named him Sancho after the character in Don Quixote. He was their servant until the age of 20. John, Duke of Montague, was a frequent guest of the sisters, and he was impressed with Ignatius's intellect, frankness, and amiability. He taught Ignatius to read and lent him books from his own library. Education enlightened him to the injustice of slavery, and he ran away to Montague House. There he worked as a butler to Lady Montague and immersed himself in music, poetry, reading, and writing. Ignatius composed at least 62 pieces of music, wrote 2 plays, and published a book on music theory. Artist Alan Ramsay's Portrait of an African is believed to have been painted of Ignatius during this period. Lady Montague died and left Ignatius a generous inheritance. In 1758, he married Anne Osborne, a West Indian woman. He was devoted to her and their 7 children. He took a job as a valet to George Montague, the son-in-law and heir of his previous patron. Artist Thomas Gainsborough painted a portrait of Ignatius at the same time the Duchess sat for a portrait. Ignatius became well known as a man of accomplishment and refinement. He was an outspoken abolitionist. His moving correspondence with novelist Lawrence Sterne became an integral part of 18th century anti-slavery literature and brought him notoriety. At 45, he bought a house and grocery store in the upmarket London neighborhood of Mayfair. His shop sold tobacco, sugar, and tea, goods which were produced by enslaved people in the West Indies. As a landowner, Ignatius had the right to vote at Westminster and was the first known person of African descent to cast a ballot in a British general election. He was a tall, big man and was noted for his warmth and charm. He was friends with many great thinkers, artists, and politicians of the day, including James Fox, who oversaw a bill in 1806 to prohibit British subjects from participating in the slave trade. Ignatius died of gout at the age of 50 and was the first person of African descent to have an obituary published in British newspapers. Actor Patterson Joseph has written a play and novel about Ignatius Sancho's life. Joseph Bologna, Chevalier de Saint-Georges was born in 1745 on the Caribbean island of Guadeloupe. His father was a French plantation owner who raped his wife's 16-year-old enslaved maid. Joseph's mother, Nanon, was of Senegalese origin. When Joseph was 7, his father took him to France. Back in 1315, King Louis X decreed that any enslaved person setting foot on French soil was free. Of course, this did not apply to France's overseas colonies, where slavery built many fortunes back in the motherland. Now free, Joseph enrolled in boarding school. 2 years later, his father returned to France with Nanon, who was reunited with her son. At 13, Joseph was enrolled in fencing school. He was immensely talented and defeated far more experienced fighters. He was entered into a highly publicized duel against the famed fencing master of Rouen. Supporters of slavery bet heavily on the master, while abolitionists bet on Joseph. Joseph won the match. His prowess earned him a place as a personal bodyguard to King Louis XV and the title Chevalier, the French equivalent of a knight. His father died and left he and his mother comfortably provided for. Next, he became famous for a second talent, music. He was a gifted violinist. His solos enraptured especially the feminine members of the audience. He composed numerous string quartets, sonatas, and symphonies, as well as plays and ballets. Beethoven held him in high regard. He became conductor of the Concert Olympique. Queen Marie Antoinette was a fan and would often sneak into performances unannounced. Joseph was the 18th century equivalent of a rock star. He was a hero to young sportsmen and musicians, and attended balls and salons with a fashionable set. He loved and was loved by many ladies, but his mixed heritage meant that he could not marry a woman of his own rank. The love of his life was Marie-Josephine de Montalembert, who was married to a much older general. Marie-Josephine gave birth to Joseph's child, but her husband took her and the baby away, and the child died. Joseph mourned deeply the loss of his love and the son he never met. It was likely the general who sent a band of 6 men to attack him in the night while he was leaving a party. They beat the chevalier and a friend with sticks, but they were able to fend off the assailants. Joseph rejected the advances of famed dancer Marie-Madeleine Guimard, but she sought revenge when he was proposed as the new director of the Paris Opera. Marie-Madeleine and 2 of her fellow divas petitioned the queen, writing that their honor could never allow them to submit to the orders of a mulatto. His operatic ambitions came crashing down. The Chevalier instead took a position as the director of the Duke d'Orléans private theater. There he lodged and worked with a young Mozart. At 45, Joseph wholeheartedly embraced the French Revolution, which advertised equal rights to all. Revolutionary leaders sent him to London, where he performed fencing exhibitions for King George III and the Prince of Wales. He fought a match with the famed Chevalier Dion, whom you can learn more about in my Transgender Nobles video. But Joseph also had a secret mission, to consolidate abolitionist support in London. While walking to his lodgings, he was attacked by assassins on a mission to stop his anti-slavery activities. But the famed fencer fought them off. Joseph returned to France with a bad taste for politics. He decided to fight for his ideals directly and signed up with the Revolutionary Army. He was appointed colonel of the first all-black regiment in Europe, which became known as the Légion Saint-Georges. But Joseph was caught up in the infighting among revolutionary leaders. He was stripped of command and imprisoned for 18 months. His loyal men called for his release, but he was not allowed to return to the army. Despondent, he traveled to the Caribbean island of Saint-Domingue to fight in support of the enslaved people in what became known as the Haitian Revolution. After 2 years there, the Chevalier returned to Paris. He died of gangrene at the age of 53 in 1799. He did not live to see the full abolition of slavery in French colonies in 1848. Joseph Bologna is the subject of the 2023 film Chevalier.
Our bodies come in different shapes and sizes, so doesn't it make sense that our weight loss plans should too? That's the beauty of Noom. They build a personal plan that factors in dietary restrictions, medical issues, and other personal needs so your plan works for you. Noom doesn't restrict or shame when you want to treat yourself. Their flexible program focuses on progress instead of perfection. You don't have to give up carbs or anything. And with their daily lessons, you can learn something new about your food choices every day. After just a few days of using the app, I learned how to recognize cues for overeating and how to choose the right foods to feel full. Stay focused on what's important to you with Noom's psychology and biology-based approach. Sign up for your trial today at Noom.com. That's Noom.com. And check out Noom's first ever cookbook, The Noom Kitchen, for 100 healthy and delicious recipes to promote better living. Available to buy now wherever books are sold.
All you need is a few minutes to start your day off with something historic when you listen to the This Day in History podcast. Every day there's a new episode for you to listen and learn about what happened that day way back when. Today could be the day a famous mobster met their end, or the first milestone for humans in space. Who knows what history today holds? Find out when you listen and subscribe to This Day in History wherever you get your podcasts. That's This Day in History wherever you get your podcasts.
Olada Equiano was born in the Kingdom of Benin in modern-day Nigeria around 1745. He recalled in his memoir that his father was a village chief who sold prisoners of war and criminals to European colonists. When he was 11, he and his sister were left home alone. They were kidnapped, separated, and sold to slave traders. He tried to escape but was thwarted. He was marched to the coast and put aboard a ship bound for Barbados, then on to the colony of Virginia. There he was purchased by a lieutenant in the Royal Navy and renamed Gustav Vasa, after the 16th century king of Sweden. Olada refused the new name and was beaten until he accepted it. The lieutenant took him to Europe to act as his valet while he fought in the Seven Years' War with France. During several battles, young Olada hauled gunpowder to the gun decks. The lieutenant sent him to England to attend school, but when he was 18, the lieutenant sold him again and he was taken back to the Caribbean. Because he was literate, Olada worked as a secretary and assistant to the merchant who owned him on his trade routes up and down the East Coast. The merchant was a Quaker and allowed him to read the Bible and engage in profitable trading of his own. He promised that for his purchase price, £40, about $10,000 today, he could purchase his freedom. He did so at the age of 21. The merchant encouraged him to stay on as a business partner, but after he was nearly kidnapped and sold back into slavery in Georgia, he decided America was too dangerous. He journeyed to England and continued to work aboard ships. He served as a deckhand on an expedition to the North Pole. Next, he moved to Central America and managed enslaved people on a sugar plantation. He returned to England at the age of 37, married Susanna Cullen, and they had two daughters. He gave lectures about his experiences of slavery and influenced people and politicians to fight for its end. All this time, he had been using the name Gustav Vasa. But in 1789, he published his autobiography, The Interesting Narrative of the Life of Olada Equiano, the African. The memoir was a bestseller in the UK, Russia, Germany, Holland, and the United States. It was one of the first widely read books written by a person of African descent. It fueled the growing anti-slavery movement and was a financial success, making Olada a wealthy man. He was a community leader among the Black citizens of London and worked to improve opportunities for them. During the American War for Independence, the British Army recruited enslaved people by offering them freedom, passage to London, and pensions. When the war was lost, the Redcoats came through with the freedom and passage, but not the pensions. Thousands were stranded in London, unable to find work and with no social safety net. And the government was eager to get rid of them. A scheme was hatched to ship them to a newly established colony on the west coast of Africa, Sierra Leone. Olada was recruited to manage supplies for the expedition, but he realized that the colony's climate was dangerous and he spoke against the plan. He was dragged in the paper as a whistleblower. But he had been right, and the expedition turned tragic. Of the 400 colonists sent to live there, only 60 were alive 5 years later. Olada's wife, Susanna, died at 34. Olada himself died a year later in 1797, age 52. His obituary was published in newspapers on both sides of the Atlantic. Dido Elizabeth Bell was born in 1761 in the British West Indies. Her mother, Maria Bell, was an enslaved African woman. Her father was naval officer Sir John Lindsay, a member of Clan Lindsay and a prominent British aristocratic family. When John returned to England, he took 4-year-old Dido with him. He left her with his uncle, William Murray, Earl of Mansfield, and his wife Elizabeth. The Murrays, who had no children of their own, raised Dido and her orphan cousin, Lady Elizabeth, at their palatial manor, Kenwood House, outside of London. The cousins were educated together, a remarkable double portrait of them hints at their close bond. Dido was treated like the rest of the family, given a fine bedroom and fashionable clothes. Guests at the manor noted 10-year-old Dido's excellent recitation of poetry. Once, when Americans came for dinner, she did not dine with the guests, but appeared later to take coffee with the ladies. It is not clear if this was so as not to offend the guests, or so that they would not have the opportunity to be rude to Dido. In her late teens, Dido took over management of the estate's dairy and poultry yards, a typical occupation for noble ladies. She also acted as a secretary to Lord Mansfield, a job which would have usually been done by a man. Lord Mansfield was Lord Chief Justice of England and Wales. In 1772, he ruled in a landmark case of an enslaved man named John Somerset, whose owner wanted to send him back to the West Indies for sale. Lord Mansfield ruled in Somerset's favor, thus setting him free. Surely his experience in raising Dido had some influence on his decision. His judgment was taken by abolitionists to mean slavery was abolished in England, though it was not actually abolished throughout the British Empire until 1833. Even then, former slave owners were compensated by British taxpayers for the loss of their human property. When Dido was 27, her father, who had since become an admiral, died and bequeathed her £500. 5 years later, Lord Mansfield died. In his will, he unequivocally confirmed Dido's freedom and bequeathed her another £500 plus a £100 annuity. Now a woman of independent means, Dido married Frenchman Jean d'Avenir. The couple bought a house in London and had 3 sons. Dido died at the age of 43 of an unknown cause. She is the subject of the 2013 film, Belle. Jean Amilcar was born in 1781 in Senegal on the west coast of Africa, at the time a French colony. He was enslaved and at the age of 6 was taken to France and presented to Queen Marie Antoinette as a gift. The queen had recently lost her youngest child, Sophie, at just 11 months. to ease her heartache she had taken to adopting orphan children. She took in 7, including Jean. Now that he was on French soil, he was free, and the queen had him baptized. He and 3 of her other adopted children did not live at the palace with the queen's biological children. Instead, she paid for them to attend boarding school. Jean remained there for 5 years. When the French Revolution broke out, the queen kept up tuition payments for as long as she could. But eventually, revolutionaries arrested the royal family and stopped the funds. And 11-year-old Jean was expelled. One of his teachers took him in and continued his education. Jean had a talent for drawing and at 15 was accepted to the Liancourt Academy in Paris with a scholarship. But he died of illness in a hospital in Paris later that same year. Thomas Alexandre Dumas was born in 1762 on the French colonial island of Saint-Domingue, modern-day Haiti. His father, Alexandre Anton, was the eldest son of the Marquis de la Patrie. He arrived in the Caribbean as part of the French army. He soon left his post to work on plantations. There he purchased an enslaved woman named Marie Cassette Dumont and forced her into a sexual relationship. She gave birth to Thomas Alexandre and 2 or 3 daughters. After Anton's parents died, he returned to France to claim the family title and chateau. He took his son with him, but sold his daughters and their mother. In order to get his son off the island, Anton had to sell him to a captain and then buy him back when they arrived in France. Thomas Alexandre attended an aristocratic school in Paris. He learned fencing from the Chevalier de Saint-Georges. His father was flush after the sale of their ancestral home, and Thomas Alexandre lived the life of a gentleman of leisure, even though he was his father's eldest son. Because he was illegitimate and mixed race, he did not stand to inherit the family title. When his father remarried, his allowance was cut, and he joined the army. Most young men of noble birth were commissioned as officers, but Thomas Alexandre's mixed race made this impossible. He instead enlisted as a private. His father, appalled that the noble name of de la Patrie would be dragged through the lowest ranks of the army, insisted his son use his mother's name, Dumas, meaning of the farm. Anton died before he saw the decorated hero his son would become, and the fame brought the name Dumas. Unaided by nepotism, Thomas Alexandre climbed the ranks through sheer talent. He served under the Marquis de Lafayette during revolutionary riots in Paris. At 31, he was the first person of color to be promoted to brigadier general in the French army. His victories in battle opened up the Alpine Pass so Napoleon could take over Italy. Austrian soldiers nicknamed him Schwarzer Teufel, or the Black Devil. The French called him Horatius, after the hero who saved ancient Rome. Thomas Alexandre married Marie-Louise Laboureille and bought a 30-acre farm for them to raise their 3 children. Next, he was appointed a commander of the cavalry in Napoleon's conquest of Egypt. Conditions were poor on the hot desert march to Cairo, and many soldiers died. General Dumas complained that the men were growing mutinous, but Napoleon ignored him and ordered him back to France. When he reached the coast, he found that British Admiral Horatio Nelson had destroyed the French Armada. He was forced to take a small merchant ship back to Europe. The vessel began to sink off the coast of Naples, Italy, and had to make an emergency landing. Dumas expected a friendly reception, but discovered the government Napoleon had just founded there had been overthrown. Dumas was tossed in a dungeon by the new King of Naples. His wife petitioned Napoleon to rescue him, but was ignored. He languished in prison for 2 years until the French retook Naples and he was set free. Malnutrition and possibly poisoning had ruined his physique. He was blind in one eye and deaf in one ear. he was denied the military pension due to him, and his family fell into poverty. Thomas Alexandre died of stomach cancer 5 years later. His son, Alexandre Dumas, used his intellect and talent to rise back out of poverty and became one of France's most illustrious writers. Some of his most famous novels, The Count of Monte Cristo, The Three Musketeers, and The Man in the Iron Mask, were partially inspired by his father's life. If you enjoyed this episode, please subscribe. I'll be putting out new episodes every Tuesday, revisiting and revamping my most popular YouTube videos, unburying some of my favorite hidden gems, and adding even more fascinating information for your listening pleasure. Want some visuals with your history? Then check out my YouTube channel, History Tea Time with Lindsay Holiday, where you can find hundreds of videos about queens of the world, royal history, women's history, and more. You can also follow History Tea Time on Instagram, Facebook, and TikTok. This podcast is part of the Airwave Media Podcast Network. Visit airwavemedia.com to listen and subscribe to other great shows like Queen's Podcast, Ancient History Fangirl, Redacted History, and more.
Hello, it is Ryan, and we could all use an extra bright spot in our day, couldn't we? Just to make up for things like sitting in traffic, doing the dishes, counting your steps, you know, all the mundane stuff. That is why I'm such a big fan of Chumba Casino. Chumba Casino has all your favorite social casino-style games that you can play for free anytime, anywhere with daily bonuses. That should brighten your day a little. Actually, a lot. So sign up now at chumbacasino.com. That's ChumbaCasino.com.
No purchase necessary. VGW. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18 plus.
Do you love history but hate when it's stuffy and boring? Well, look no further and join me, Katie Charlwood, your friendly neighborhood social scientist and reader of books, as I delve into unsolved historical mysteries, murders by gaslight, and of course, women who have been misrepresented through all time. On Who Did What Now, the history podcast that's not your history class. Listen wherever you get your podcasts.